The second case set for argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Michael O'Neill. Catherine Dunn is present on behalf of Mr. O'Neill and will be arguing this morning. And Aaron Hanke from the Attorney General's office will be arguing on behalf of the State of South Dakota. Again, both of you will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Ms. Dunn, you'll have a 5-minute rebuttal. You can proceed at this time, Ms. Dunn.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'm here today asking this court to grant a new trial for Michael O'Neill. Given the time limitations, I plan to address the following before the court today. The first would be Mr. O'Neill's Fourth Amendment claim, particularly as it relates to the attenuation doctrine. The second would be the erroneous admission of exhibits 1A, 3A, 4A, 5A, 6A, and 7A, and the trial court's misapplication of Rule 403 and 404B as it relates to said exhibits. And lastly, the failure to preserve evidence due to the 13-month pre-accusatorial delay in this matter. If the court has any additional questions related to the remaining issues, I will address those as well. Beginning with the attenuation doctrine. In this case, the attenuation doctrine is not applicable. In order for the attenuation doctrine to apply, the first thing that needs to happen is an intervening circumstance. So when the court ruled sua sponte that attenuation was the justification for the search in this matter, there was no actual intervening circumstance, and the court's decision actually would indicate that based on the three factors of attenuation, that there, in fact, was not an intervening circumstance.
Why wasn't the search warrant an intervening circumstance?
The search warrant is not an intervening circumstance because it happened after the fact. I think case law recognizes that if there is an intervening circumstance, it's either changes the trajectory of what occurred or is a pre-existing situation. So as in,
well, how would it not have changed the trajectory if it happens, if it's intervening, if it happens prior to the discovery of evidence? Why is that not intervening?
The search warrant is what led to the additional discovery of evidence. They do not get to the phone, they do not get to the phone due to it if they didn't already unlawfully seize it.
So there are interrelated doctrines that are exceptions to the exclusionary rule, and one of them the court indicates was argued as the inevitable discovery. And are there circumstances like this one where more than one doctrine can apply, in particularly the inevitable discovery doctrine that was apparently before the court? We don't have the underlying briefs in the record here that would pertain to whether the phone would have inevitably been discovered and lawfully seized.
The trial court found that inevitable discovery did not apply and that there were no facts to sufficiently support that finding. I think as it relates to inevitable discovery, there has to be another track of an investigation where it was already heading that way. And in this case, that is not what occurred.
So the information that ultimately supported the search warrant, would that not have ultimately supported a warrant to seize the phone?
No, because at the time the phone was seized, the Officer Hansen did not have the information as that was laid out in the search warrant affidavit.
Excuse me, he didn't have what information?
The information that was laid out in the ultimate search warrant affidavit.
All of that information, well, the majority of that information pertained to what was obtained from Mr. O'Neill's fiance, which was before he had any contact with Mr. O'Neill or the phone.
So, however, the additional information occurred due to the seizure of the phone, the obtaining the passcode, confirming the passcode, using it to put it in airplane mode, even looking at the phone, telling him to turn over the phone.
The passcode was initially obtained from his fiance.
Correct. However, that's still information that had to be confirmed. We're dealing with the fiance's statement. That in and of itself did not create probable cause. There were additional factors that had to be, that ultimately formed the basis of the information that was in the affidavit. And so at the time the phone was seized, there was certainly was not probable cause to seize it.
And that, you know, I would agree that all of this would hinge if we're talking about probable cause in the warrant itself, whether it was supported ultimately by probable cause. It seems to me like the application of any of these exceptions to the exclusionary rule would hinge on whether or not there was, in fact, probable cause. Would you agree with that?
I think case law concerning the seizure of property has discussed if there is probable cause to do so, it then determines whether it is reasonable or not. So there are times where the court has allowed that. That being said, I think it is of note that what they are seizing is a phone. It's not another inanimate object. I think the case law, as the Supreme Court continues to make decisions relating to telephonic devices, notes that what we contain in our phones and how we use them show that they are more of an integral part of our person. And so the searches of them require the warrants as it relates to different items. So, for example, an officer can have probable cause to search a purse, and that may be allowed under Carroll, but they can't search the phone and the purse. They have to go and get a separate search warrant for it. So I think it is at least of note that the item that was seized at this time was a phone. As it relates to probable cause, again, I think that is a significant factor for the court to consider at the time of seizure, but our position is there was not probable cause at the time that occurred.
So the attenuation doctrine contemplates an unconstitutional search or seizure. That seems to be obviously what the circuit court decided here. But it also contemplates an interruption, as we discussed, some sort of an intervening circumstance, such that whatever constitutional guarantee that was at issue or had been violated wouldn't be served by the remedy of exclusion, which, of course, is created by judges, not by the Fourth Amendment. So the remedy of exclusion is a judicially created remedy. And so it seems like your argument is focused, which I understand, is focused on the primacy of this unlawful seizure. But at some point, I mean, that's contemplated, one. And two, why wouldn't a subsequent finding of probable cause constitute an intervening circumstance that would attenuate that initial taint?
The reason being, one, it's, I would say that the seizure of the phone is an ongoing violation. And so if we're going to discuss the application of the attenuation doctrine, and we don't concede that the warrant is the intervening circumstance, but if we're going to discuss it as that attenuation or that intervening circumstance.
And to be clear, I don't want to interrupt you, continue, but to be clear, the police received nothing of evidentiary value from the phone prior to the warrant. They just held it.
Correct. But the phone is evidence in and of itself. I mean, they don't have the phone, they can't execute a search warrant on an item they don't have.
But you say them holding the phone is a continuing violation, but it's only a continuing violation until the law enforcement officers go and get a valid search warrant from the court. That's the attenuation doctrine.
I don't think the attenuation doctrine applies even to that, because I think if you look at the flagrancy and the purpose of the conduct, law enforcement went with purpose to retrieve that phone. They went to conduct an investigation. They did not give Mr. O'Neill the opportunity to consent. He was told, I'm seizing this phone, I need the passcode, and was followed as he went to retrieve it. And so if we look at what law enforcement was doing, they went to take the phone. They acted with purpose. They acted with knowledge of what they were doing. I think it's also worth noting that in the search warrant affidavit in and of itself, the way the taking of the phone, the way law enforcement doesn't actually even seem to know how they took the phone. It says Officer Hansen spoke with Michael, who also gave the passcode to be used to unlock the phone and place the phone into airplane mode. I think it's interesting that that affidavit glosses over just in fact how they retrieved the phone. And so I think that omission in the search warrant is a reflection of the fact that they knew they shouldn't have taken the phone.
So are you saying, let's say they had put in the affidavit, we took the phone without probable cause and without consent, we just took it. Let's say that they put that in the affidavit. Are you saying court would have said, well, I can't even issue a search warrant for the information in the phone because you got to first legally get the phone?
I think that would raise a significant red flag for a judge determining probable cause, because I think still looking within a probable cause determination, when courts are analyzing at warrants, even, you know, when in different circumstances, when you have to strike the unlawful evidence, if you strike the unlawful obtaining of the phone, then what is left? And so I think if the affidavit said, yes, we unlawfully seized this phone, I would like to think the court would have had pause before issuing a warrant.
So your brief on appeal makes no argument that with regard to information in the actual affidavit, in the four corners of the affidavit, that could not be considered in our review of whether it contained probable cause. It did not appear, at least from the court's memorandum opinion, that that argument was made below either. And again, we don't have the briefs in the appellate record here. So are you now making that argument?
Sorry, can you clarify your question?
I didn't see anywhere where you had raised the argument on behalf of Mr. O'Neill that anything within the four corners of the affidavit could not be considered when we review the probable cause, the issue of whether it contained probable cause.
I think it was raised on briefing as it related to probable cause for issuance of the search warrant. I think there were two motions to suppress filed, one for the seizure of the phone, the other as it relates to probable cause in the search warrant itself. So I think those are, and the court decided.
I'm talking about the specific information detailed in the affidavit.
The specific, that is.
I did not see any argument made that anything in the affidavit could not properly be considered by the circuit court or this court in our review of whether it contained probable cause.
Sorry, and I'm not saying that it can't be considered. In fact, the opposite. I believe it is worth noting that the law enforcement noted how they obtained the phone is a reflection of how they knew they were acting with purpose as it relates to the third tenet of the attenuation doctrine.
So, Ms. Dunn, maybe you want to move on to those other issues. I know you had some other things you wanted to talk about.
And I'd be specifically interested in hearing your argument about the additional images that you argue were improperly admitted by the trial court.
Thank you, Your Honor. As to the 404B evidence, the trial court abused its discretion in admitting exhibits 1A. I'm going to call it the A exhibits for time. Prior to trial, counsel for Mr. O'Neill filed a motion for a bill of particulars seeking specifically what are called MD5 hash values for each count in the indictment. On the date of the motions hearing in July of 2021, the state provided said hash values. The following months leading up to trial, defense relied upon these specific hash values as the charged offenses and used those and built a defense around those specific images. Counts 1 through 7 deal with the phone, and so that's specifically what I am discussing. The hash values were thumbnails. Now, thumbnail is not a user-created image. It is an operating system-created image. And so there is a major difference between preparing a case around thumbnails where the operating system created this image and the actual image where it shows a user access to the image. Thumbnails have evidentiary value, but they can simply show an image was there. And so it was not until the day before trial and frankly, in the middle of trial, that the state realized their error that they had alleged thumbnails and then sought to introduce the A exhibits. And their reasoning for such was that it went to show knowledge, but what it really had the effect of doing was being considered as evidence of the primary offense.
Why wasn't this race just part and parcel the context of the crimes alleged in each count?
So res justi, based on the court's case law, is so when evidence is so connected to something that you can't explain one without explaining the other. This is not res justi. This is not other acts to support a different act. This is the better evidence to support the evidence they should have had in their first hash value. This was something where the state realized their error and was trying to get this information and call it knowledge. So this is not res justi.
Let me just stop you.
Sorry.
Shirley, do you want to add 5 minutes onto Pellant's time, and then you can add 5 minutes onto the state time?
Go ahead. The way this evidence was admitted was, one, it was admitted without notice. Two, the court did not find cause for this evidence to be admitted without notice, and then didn't do a proper weighing.
Counsel, it seemed to me like your argument both below and here is not so much that it did not have relevance, whether it's res justi or whether it fits with under a 404B purpose for admitting evidence. It seemed to me like your primary argument was the prejudice that you would experience by the late identification of these particular images. Is that a fair assessment?
That is correct. And so what happened was, and it was repeatedly objected to and emphasized at the trial court level, was the limited access that counsel had to these images. Counsel had prepared a defense around these, and then the day of trial, I think even on the record as they were reviewing the A images, the state said, well, there's only two, and defense counsel had to say, no, you've actually identified six of the seven counts as thumbnails, and so had to correct the state again. And so they were completely caught off guard for what they had prepared.
So, and there's no dispute here that the images, the A images, were the exact same photo as in the thumbnail, correct? And from my review of the court's determination is that this wasn't a discovery issue because defense and their computer forensic expert had this information all along, just did not choose to focus on anything other than the specific images that were identified in response to the request for a bill of particulars. And, you know, from there, it appeared the court then determined that in weighing the balance, that the probative value was not substantially outweighed by any undue prejudice that resulted in the defense's decision to only focus on those identified images.
So I think, so the focus of having the state identify the hash values when we're dealing with over a million images within these devices is to, one, provide notice of and a lack of a surprise for what is supposed to be what we're supposed to expect for trial. She needed to be able to defend against the accusations and to be able to identify that. It's important to note that federal law, we don't have actual access or unfettered access to these items, and neither does the state. Our expert used a locked office within the U.S. Attorney's Office. Our expert was the one who had to review these items,
It appeared that before they were actually admitted and the court issued its ruling, that the judge went on the record with counsel, the expert present, went through each of these offered A images, and the counsel and the expert were allowed to see them. Where can you explain what the specific prejudice then would be after having that. I've not seen any more specific argument as to ultimately how that prejudiced the ability then to cross-examine and to develop the defense.
This happened the day of trial. They had already selected a jury and were arguing motions. The prejudice is this was a case that had been had a 13-month delay in pre-accusation and then multiple motions filed, hearings held, and a defense was prepared, experts were retained, and then the day of trial they had to pivot from defending against thumbnails, which that is a really strong argument on defense to say you can't knowingly possess a user image that is generated by an operating system. It's a different defense, and having to pivot in the middle of trial the entirety of the case caused significant prejudice.
Was there no other discovery that indicated through a report or something that the state may have generated that, hey, we actually have evidence that Mr. O'Neill accessed these thumbnails or access the actual images? I mean, he's charged with possessing 15 images. So is there, I mean, that's what the charge is. Is there a report or something that says, yeah, we actually have evidence that he actually accessed them?
So the evidence that would have been available through the Cellebrite reader, I think that was what was presented, would support that
claim. I'm looking for
claim,
notice.
But,
did you have, was there notice? Was there some discovery that said, you know, because the image is, the A image is the same as the image in the hash value. And I understand the distinction that you're making. But ultimately, this is not a new image. I'm not even sure it's 404B or res gestae. It's the same image.
And I'm out of time. I'll address that on rebuttal. Thank you.
You can respond to the
I question. Can respond. Okay, thank you. So what I would say is that the Detective Buss didn't write a report, and that was throughout the entirety of the trial as well. And so, no, the reports were Officer Bertram's, the initial images found, and then what happened is the defense repeatedly wanted the MD5 hash values to lock down what exactly it was defending. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dunn. You may proceed with your argument, Ms. Hanke.
May it please the court, counsel. I'll just go ahead and start right off where you left off, Justice Salter. I don't disagree with your evaluation. I don't know that these images, other images, these 1A images are fall under 404B. Obviously, that's what the circuit court allowed them in as, but these were all turned over, and it's the identical image that was present in that thumbnail. We're just blowing it up. And obviously, the state used that evidence to show that defendant knowingly possessed that image, knowingly clicked on that image, and viewed that image.
The argument, though, is that even if that's all true, and it seems like it is, the argument is that springing this on them on the day of trial really disrupted the defense strategy, which was that these thumbnail images were really users, you know, some sort of user system or operating system, I should say, generated images. And they in and of themselves wouldn't really support the element of knowing possession. So it does seem disruptive for their strategy if that's the way they built their case up to that point, particularly if there's no discovery or any report of an expert or something up to that point that says, oh yeah, we actually, you know, have this derivative image, which is bigger, blown up, and that indicates that he possessed them. So they might have been laboring under that view that there was no evidence that he possessed them.
There was still, they still had all of this. They got the same data that the state had access to. My understanding is the state turned all of that over to defense. So they had access to all of those images that they could have gone in and viewed and looked at and seen the real images.
Right, but she says there's a million images, and she says, we asked the state, tell us what images you are actually prosecuting our client for, and the state gives a bill of particulars that says these are the images, and it happens to be the thumbnails rather than the actual images. So it isn't just about discovery. It's about a specific request for a bill of particulars that was answered by the state.
I would argue, Justice Myron, though, that defense withdrew that motion. A bill of particulars was filed with the circuit court. And my understanding is, off the record, there was some discussion between the state and defense, and information was turned over. I do not believe that the state's version of, hey, these MDH hash values, these are the ones we're going to use, those are, that's not part of the record. I don't know what the state turned over to defense. I should say that, Your Honor, it's not part of the record. I believe there was a hearing and judge asked, hey, what about this bill particulars? And it was just, we've worked this out amongst ourselves. We can readdress it later if we need to. I'll kind of switch gears a little bit here and jump back to the attenuation doctrine. Justice Devaney, I believe you had asked Ms. Dunn if there was probable, law enforcement had probable cause to seize the phone. And I would argue, yes, they did. Just off of the fiance's information she provided alone was enough probable cause for the law enforcement to go take that phone. There was probable cause just with her statement alone.
So, and the reason that would be pertinent is if we were also applying in conjunction with, whether it's in conjunction or in lieu of, with other doctrines that pertain to exceptions to the exclusionary rule, whether the phone would have inevitably been seized pursuant to a probable cause warrant in any event. Notwithstanding what the unlawful conduct the court found actually happened. Would you agree that's why the connection there?
Yes, I agree. The doctrines are so interconnected and intertwined. But yes, I do agree that just based off of the fiancé's statements, there would have been enough probable cause, whether or not they applied for a search warrant that day or inevitable discovery, there was enough probable cause just based off of her information.
Okay, and then to carry it through to the ultimate search that was done based on the search warrant that was in fact issued to search the contents of the phone, was there any taint that impacted that warrant as a result of the unlawful warrantless seizure of the phone?
I just want to clarify your question to make sure I understood, Justice Devaney. Are you asking whether or not there was information in the probable cause affidavit that was known to law enforcement because they took the phone?
Yeah, a fruit of the poisonous tree. We assume that the phone was unlawfully seized. Was there anything in the subsequent warrant that we cannot consider when we're determining if it was supported by probable cause?
At best, it would be corroborating evidence, and by that I mean, excuse me, the fiancé told law enforcement, hey, I found this on my fiancé's phone. It's a gold iPhone with a black and white case and a crack in the screen. That information was obviously corroborated once the phone was seized. Law enforcement could corroborate that information. But even if you take that corroboration out of the affidavit, the fiancé's statements alone were enough to support that probable cause affidavit.
So you can address that further. Opposing counsel has made several arguments as to why, in their view, they do not think that was sufficient probable cause based on her statements alone.
So her statement, excuse me, her statement was basically, I found an image of a 10 to an 11-year-old girl. She had a very young face. She was topless. She was underdeveloped. And that was a firsthand, she saw that image firsthand. That was firsthand knowledge. Not only was it firsthand knowledge, but she, when you look at like a tipster information, we give more credibility to an informant who identifies themselves. I understand she wished to remain anonymous. However, her name was out there for all the world to see in that affidavit. And not only that, it was a very detailed description of wrongdoing. It wasn't one of those tips law enforcement sometimes see from callers driving down the interstate, hey, I think the car in front of me is intoxicated. This was a detailed description of, we have an underage girl who is shirtless on my fiance's phone. So it was a very detailed description. And an informant whose identity is known, who personally observes an alleged criminal activity and openly risks liability by accusing another of criminal activity, doesn't necessarily need further corroboration by law enforcement. So her statement was enough.
Counsel, O'Neill argues that his rights were violated by the pre-indictment delay and that the case should have been dismissed and that the trial court erred in not granting his motion to dismiss. I'd like to hear your response to that argument.
Sure, Your Honor. So when you have a pre-indictment delay...
Here it's 13 months
right.
from search warrant to indictment.
Yes. So when you have a pre-indictment delay, we kind of look at things a little bit different because once you're indicted, you have the 180-day rule that this court has adopted. You don't have that for pre-indictment, but you look at a couple things. First, O'Neill must show that he was prejudiced by that delay, and then that the delay was intentional to gain a tactical advantage. And I understand that O'Neill's argument is he was prejudiced because there were two recordings defense had sought that no longer are in existence, if they ever were. I will say that the two recordings were the interaction with O'Neill's fiance that she had with law enforcement. There's some belief that that was recorded by law enforcement. However, in reviewing the record, I can't see where that was actually recorded or not. In looking at the state, what the state argued in their in the hearing, it wasn't clear if that recording ever even existed. And then obviously there was the recording that Officer Hansen had, just the audio recording of the interaction between himself and O'Neill. And I don't see how that can prejudice defendant by that being gone, if it ever was uploaded. Again, there was some kind of question if it was uploaded to the system, if it wasn't.
And, of course, Mr. O'Neill was present for that one.
Absolutely. Mr. O'Neill was present for that one.
Presumably, he would know what was said. And
yes.
Is there a proffer in that regard? I was looking for one, and I may have missed it. Is there some sort of a proffer by the defense to say, hey, we're really prejudiced by this delay? You know, Mr. O'Neill was there. He remembers this exchange happening, and now we don't have the recording to confirm it.
Not that I saw, Your Honor. And to go off of that, not only was Mr. O'Neill there, but I think at best this recording would help their argument in terms of an unlawful seizure. I believe the state initially argued many things in terms of this encounter, but did initially argue this was a consensual encounter. So if anything, that would maybe help or hinder Mr. O'Neill's position in that it was an unlawful seizure.
But the court ruled it was unlawful.
So unlawful. Again, that goes to where's the prejudice then, Your Honor?
And at trial, the officer testified in fairly favorable terms. Mr. O'Neill was cooperative, and it was a seemingly a cordial exchange between the two of them.
Right. So, I said, it would go more towards whether that was a consensual encounter or not. And the circuit court ultimately ruled that was not a consensual encounter. And so, again, there's no prejudice there then by that missing recording.
But besides prejudice, the test requires a showing that the law enforcement delayed the prosecution for tactical gain. Mm-hmm. Tell me about
There was no evidence of that, Justice Myron. The state talked about how there was just a lot of data. Not only was there a lot of data, but it took a long time for law enforcement to actually get access to that data. There was some struggle getting into the cell phone. I think that took a month or two. They tried a couple various programs. So then they get into the cell phone. Then I believe about a month later, they got the search warrant for the hard drive, O'Neill's hard drive, and that took a while to access all that information.
Did O'Neill present any evidence or even argument that the state had done something for tactical advantage?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. Like I said, it was just a very voluminous amount of material to go through. As Ms. Dunn said, it was over 1 million images, and that takes a long time to just sift through everything, not only download it all, but sift through it all and see what all is there. Uh-huh. Unless the court has any additional questions, the state would just ask this court to affirm O'Neill's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hanke. Ms. Dunn, you can proceed with your rebuttal.
Thank you.
On that last point, was there evidence presented that would tend to show some tactical advantage that the state attempted to gain by delaying the prosecution?
No, there is no evidence of a tactical advantage.
So do we even need to talk about prejudice? If there's no showing of tactical advantage, then that two-part test cannot be met, right?
The review of case law discusses primarily the prejudice, and then looks, once that showing is made, then to the state's reason for the delay, whether it was an investigative purpose. I don't think there was any sort of findings or record made as to tactical advantage. The concerning issue presented by defense was the lost evidence. And what is equally concerning is that the state didn't even know if evidence was lost. And I think that is something to note. We know that when Ms. Guggenberger called law enforcement, the affidavit said she called Metro Communications. She testified at trial that she called the non-emergency line. It's hard to believe there wasn't a recording of that.
How do we review that for prejudice? You know, that's the tough part, and it's kind of inherent in this type of argument that we would have to speculate as to that there might have been something, you know, what, impeaching or something different said or not shared. So that seems to require us to speculate as to what might have been on a recording if it existed. How do you get over that hurdle?
It's a very difficult hurdle to overcome. And I think the issue and the problem with this is when you are preparing a case for trial, what you want to have is you want that recording. You want to know exactly what was said, because that is how you are going to know more than anybody else going into that room and cross-examining that witness. And so the prejudice is you have somebody who has less information, is less prepared, and unwittingly so, because evidence is missing. And the prejudice also comes from the fact that if we know this is documented, that this is recorded, why isn't it saved? If we know that this is an investigation, why isn't it preserved? If we know that it only lasts so long on a server, why didn't anybody keep it?
But we don't have a proffer setting out the evidence of how long it was held on the server, if it was even held on the server. What if it was held 3 days on the server? Are they turned over every week? And so it's difficult to review the claim of prejudice. How about the second part of this, the interview or the interaction between your client and the deputy when the phone was seized?
I think the trial court lamented not having that as well in its decision, that it would have helped for a better understanding of the nature of the interaction between the two. The officer actually, even in his testimony, made a statement. He said there was an argument, and then corrected himself and said conversation. And it's an interesting way to phrase something if this officer doesn't have a different recollection one way or the other. Now, that wasn't developed, but again, this type of interaction would have been beneficial. I would also note, as to a proffer, the record would reflect that Mr. O'Neill was subjected to a competency evaluation. Now, he was found competent. Typically, when those evaluations, they're requested for a reason, and so to what extent any proffer would have been made or practical, I'm just not, unfortunately, at a position to answer that.
Of course, you won that fight, right? The circuit court found it was an unlawful seizure of the phone based on the testimony that was provided. So how on earth would having something more end up prejudicing?
I'm still fighting that fight right now. I would say that there's more too, and I think that when we go to attenuation, if attenuation is indeed found to be applicable to this, what we are looking at is how bad was that? And if there was a situation where the officer bullied Mr. O'Neill into turning over his phone, that matters. And again, his statement as to an argument is notable. But so that's how I think that would apply. And then just to touch on attenuation, because I really do want to get the point across as it relates to attenuation and inevitable discovery, that when we're looking at case law as it relates to both, and particularly as to inevitable discovery, there was no probable cause at the time the phone was taken. There was not a search warrant in the works. There was no consultation with the prosecuting an attorney saying, hey, we're working on this. They weren't there just to preserve. They were there to seize. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dunn. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments this morning. The court will be in recess for 5 minutes.